What's the universe at time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Pro-government forces in Syria, backed by Russian air power, reportedly advanced slowly Tuesday on the rebel-held sector of Aleppo. Meanwhile, the U.S. announced it was abandoning talks with Moscow over efforts at salvaging a ceasefire. Speaking Tuesday in Brussels, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said Washington is not abandoning the peace process.
We are not giving up on the Syrian people. We are not abandoning the pursuit of peace. We are not going to leave the multilateral field. We are going to continue to try to find a way forward in order to end this war. And we will do everything possible through the International Syria Support Group, through the United Nations, or even through smaller multilateral meetings in order to try to find a way forward.
He lashed out at Russia and Syria for pursuing what he called a military solution. Meanwhile, the Russian military said it's deploying air defense missiles to protect Russian forces in the Syrian port of Tartus. Defense Ministry spokesman Major General Igor Konashenkov called on the U.S. to recognize almost all the Syrian opposition it supports is part of the al-Qaeda and Jabhat al-Nusra insurgency. South African police Tuesday fired rubber bullets, tear gas, and stun grenades at student protesters in Johannesburg as authorities tried to reopen Wits University. It's been the scene of weeks of demonstrations over tuition fee hikes. Sharia Kale is a student protest leader.
We've been brutalized and we've been peaceful. And each time we try to maintain order and discipline. But at some point, something has got to show the kind of brutality and the kind of disorder that the police are trying to create.
Protesters insist the fee hikes force poorer, often black people, out of education. This is VOA News. A fierce late-season hurricane, the worst in a decade, battered the Caribbean nation of Haiti Tuesday with 200-plus kilometer-per-hour winds, torrential rainfall, and surging seas flooding coastal towns. Matthew, a Category 4 storm, tore through the island of Hispaniola, which includes the Dominican Republic. More than 100 centimeters of rainfall was expected. Residents of the Bahamas are bracing for Matthew's wrath as it moves in a northwesterly direction slowly.
My stomach tells me that this one might be bad. But we live in hope and we trust that everything works out well for us.
Resident Andy Gill of the Bahamian capital Nassau, eastern Cuba, also bracing for Matthew. Hurricane watchers are already out for parts of Florida, with the storm expected to strike the U.S. East Coast later this week. South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley ordered the evacuation of hundreds of thousands of residents from the coastline beginning Wednesday.
We will be starting evacuations tomorrow afternoon, so we ask that everybody start getting your things together that you have. Start contacting your family. Start thinking about where you're going to go and how you're going to go.
Some 1 million people may be affected. The governors of Florida and Georgia have also declared states of emergency. The UN is appealing to the international community to pay more attention to Yemen, considered one of the worst humanitarian crises in the world. Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs Stephen O'Brien ended a three-day visit to Yemen and said Tuesday that 80% of the population is in need of some form of humanitarian aid.
So of the 40 million who are food insecure, 7 million do not know where the next meal is coming from.
Yemen is one of the Arab world's poorest countries, relying heavily on imports of food, and has suffered massive food shortages since the conflict there broke out. At least 3 civilians were killed, a dozen wounded in the Libyan city Benghazi Tuesday, after several rockets believed fired by Islamic State fighters detonated in the city's center. The area is near fighting between forces of Eastern Commander Field Marshal Khalifa Haftar and IS remnants. Zimbabwe's High Court Tuesday upheld a month-long police ban on protests in the capital to preserve peace. Former Finance Minister Tendai Biti had challenged the ban in the court, insisting it violated individual rights. 3 American university professors won the Nobel Prize for Physics for their work on exotic states of matter, including F. Duncan Haldane.
I feel very gratified to have played a part with my co-laureates in coming up with new ways of thinking in condensed matter physics.
His British-born colleagues are David Thewlis and J. Michael Kosterlitz. They are credited for bringing forth a new and totally unexpected understanding of the way solid materials behave. The International Monetary Fund says global growth remains weak and predicts that advanced economies will expand more slowly this year. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Barté in Washington. Today's Wednesday, October 5th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The two vice presidential candidates in this year's U.S. election faced off last night in their first and only debate.
Hillary and I believe in comprehensive immigration reform. Hillary and I want a bipartisan reform that will put keeping families together as the top goal. Second, that will help focus enforcement efforts on those who are violent.
That's Democratic Vice Presidential candidate Tim Kaine. Dialogue resumes between the DRC government and the opposition. Liberia's Supreme Court is considering today whether the removal of the Speaker of the House of Representatives was constitutional. And the West African Court of Justice tells Nigeria to free former security advisor Sambo Dasuki.
For the truth of the matter, we have a tradition of compliance with the rule of law and the judgment of the court. But then definitely the options available to us within the context of the rule of law should be exploited.
Abubakar Malami is Attorney General of Nigeria, and South Sudanese refugees from Morobo say people are dying in Ugandan refugee camps. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The two vice presidential candidates in this year's U.S. election faced off last night in their first and only debate. They talked about the differences in their presidential candidates' immigration policies. First, Democrat Tim Kaine.
There's two plans on the table. Hillary and I believe in comprehensive immigration reform. Donald Trump believes in deportation nation. You got to pick your choice. Hillary and I want a bipartisan reform that will put keeping families together as the top goal. Second, that will help focus enforcement efforts on those who are violent. Third, that will do more border control. And fourth, that will provide a path to citizenship for those who work hard, pay taxes, play by the rules, and take criminal background record checks. That's our proposal. Donald Trump proposes to deport 16 million people, 11 million who are here without documents. And both Donald Trump and Mike Pence want to get rid of birthright citizenship. So if you're born here, but your parents don't have documents, they want to eliminate that. That's another 4.5 million people.
Republican vice presidential candidate Governor Mike Pence also spoke about Donald Trump's immigration policy.
Well, I think Donald Trump laid out a series of priorities that doesn't end with border security. It begins with border security. And after we secure the border, not only build a wall, but beneath the ground and in the air, we do internal enforcement. But he said the focus has to be on criminal aliens. We just had a conversation about law enforcement. We just had a conversation about the violence that's besetting our cities. The reality is that there's heartbreak and tragedy that has struck American families because people that came into this country illegally are now involved in criminal enterprise and activity, and we don't have the resources or the will to deport them systematically. Donald Trump has said we're going to move those people out. People who've overstayed their visas, we're going to enforce the law of this country. We're going to strengthen immigrations and customs enforcements with more resources and more personnel to be able to do that. And then Donald Trump has made it clear, once we've done all of those things, that we're going to reform the immigration system.
The two vice presidential candidates also discussed Donald Trump's refusal to release his federal income taxes. First, Democrat Senator Tim Kaine.
Donald Trump started this campaign in 2014. He said, if I run for president, I will absolutely release my taxes. He's broken his first promise. Second, he stood on the stage last week, and when Hillary said you haven't been paying taxes, he said, that makes me smart. So it's smart not to pay for our military. It's smart not to pay for veterans. It's smart not to pay for teachers. And I guess all of us who do pay for those things, I guess we're stupid. And the last thing I'll say,
Senator,
is this.
Senator, do you take all the deductions that you're entitled to?
The last thing I want to ask Governor Pence is
I do.
This. Governor Pence had to give Donald Trump his tax returns to show he was qualified to be vice president. Donald Trump must give the American public his tax returns to show that he's qualified to be president, and he's breaking his promise.
Governor Mike Pence also discussed Donald Trump's refusal to release his taxes.
Donald Trump is a businessman, not a career politician. He actually built a business. Those tax returns that came out publicly this week showed that he faced some pretty tough times 20 years ago. But like virtually every other business, including the New York Times not too long ago, he used what's called net operating loss. We have a tax code, Senator, that actually is designed to encourage entrepreneurship.
But why won't he release his tax return?
Well, we're answering the question about the business thing. His tax return that showed he went through a very difficult time, but he used the tax code just the way it's supposed to be used, and he did it brilliantly.
How do you know that? You haven't seen his
runway
tax return.
Because he's created a business that's worth billions of dollars today.
How do you know that?
And with regard to paying taxes, this whole riff about not paying taxes and people saying he didn't pay taxes for years, Donald Trump has created tens of thousands of jobs.
That's Republican vice presidential candidate Governor Mike Pence. You also heard Senator Tim Kaine, the Democratic vice presidential candidate. The Democratic Republic of Congo's main opposition coalition, Le Rassemblement, on Tuesday announced the conclusion of a two-week conclave. Among agenda items was their response to President Joseph Kabila's intention to stay in power beyond the end of his second term and a clarification of the platform's position on talks it has so far boycotted. William Claus has the latest from Kinshasa.
Several hundred delegates of the Rassemblement, a platform comprising of most of the DRC's opposition parties, began arriving for the ceremony held in the Congolese capital, Kinshasa, on Tuesday morning. They were there to hear how their leaders planned to respond to the delay of elections which was supposed to happen in November, and President Joseph Kabila's intention to stay in office beyond the end of his second term on December 19th. Etienne Tshisekedi, leader of the Rassemblement, or the Assembly, is a veteran Congolese opposition politician. Tshisekedi spoke of protests organized by the Rassemblement on September 19th, in which more than 50 people died, saying it had been a warning to Kabila.
Mais le 19 octobre, nous lui donnerons une carte.
He said on October 19th, the Rassemblement would gather again and give a yellow card to Kabila.
La carte jaune signifiant que 19 décembre.
And on December 19th, he said the opposition would give the president a red card, continuing the soccer analogy for penalizing a player. The Rassemblement, which has been meeting behind closed doors for several weeks, gave its final report before Tshisekedi closed the ceremony. If Kabila stays beyond the end of his second term, the group said that it will consider the president guilty of high treason. The report also condemned ongoing talks between supporters of Kabila and a smaller opposition platform, dismissing it as a pseudo-dialogue and a monologue to legitimize the president's strategy of conserving power and violating the constitution. The Rassemblement said it would be willing to commit to alternative talks if a number of conditions were first met, including the liberation of all political prisoners, the end of politically motivated legal cases against opposition leaders, the end of intimidation and threats against opposition members, and the reopening of shuttered opposition media outlets. The opposition groups also called for the removal of Edem Kodjo, the current mediator of the talks. Kodjo is a former Togolese prime minister who was appointed to the position by the African Union. Freddy Matangulu, a senior figure in the Rassemblement, told VOA that he hopes Kabila's alliance and his opposition group can come to agreement for new talks.
What do we do to avoid the country going into a legal limbo beyond the 19th of December, which is the date when President Kabila's second and last term in office actually ends. We need to now go to the inclusive dialogue, and this one will involve people from President Kabila's alliance and those from Rassemblement coming together and putting their ideas together and developing, as I said, a consensus so that this difficult political situation is sorted out in the best way possible for the country.
Also on Tuesday, Kabila spoke about the country's electoral difficulties, an issue he last discussed publicly in August. During a visit to Tanzania, he told reporters that Congolese authorities were delaying the elections to avoid preventing a huge number of unregistered people from being able to vote. Opponents acknowledged the importance of updating the electoral roll, but claimed that it is the fault of the government that voter registration only recently got underway. William Clouds for VOA News, Kinshasa.
to this Wednesday, October 5th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is now 15 minutes past the hour. The Nigerian government says it is studying the ruling of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS Court of Justice, concerning the arrest and detention of Sambo Dasuki. The court ruled on Tuesday that the 2015 arrest and detention of Dasuki, the security advisor to former President Goodluck Jonathan, was unlawful and arbitrary. The court also held that searches of Dasuki's homes in Abuja and northern Sokoto and the forceful seizure of his property in July 2015 was a violation of his right to own property. The court ordered the government to release Dasuki and to pay 15 million naira as damages for violation of his rights. Abubakar Malami, the Attorney General of Nigeria, says the government is studying the court's ruling.
Well, it's true there was a judgment that has been handed down by the ECOWAS court to that effect. But then, as you rightly know, the provision of the applicable statute, particularly Section 63 thereof, has made provision for reconsideration in the event of dissent with the court judgment. What I'm trying to put across is that there is that provision in the statutes applicable, but then we are studying the judgment and see which way we are going to operate. But the truth of the matter, we have a tradition of compliance with the rule of law and the judgments of the court. But then definitely the options available to us within the context of the rule of law should be exploited.
I do understand, Mr. Attorney General, I know you are studying the ruling. The court says that the arrest was unlawful and arbitrary and that Mr. Dasuki was detained without charge or judicial order. Any response to that?
No. There are pending cases in court and then there are pending investigations. So the issue of detaining without trial is out of question because he has been subjected to trial through the appropriate court of law. The thinking along the line of being detained without trial does not arise. But then, in line with our statute, if you have multiple cases, multiple investigations, the possibility of taking someone to custody for the purpose of the conduct of certain investigations in respect of other offenses is there. So what I'm trying to put across is that there could be multiplicity of investigations, multiplicity of cases. So it all depends on the prevailing circumstances.
So you are saying, Mr. Attorney General, that Mr. Dasuki's trial arrest was in line with Nigerian law?
The initial arrest was in line with the Nigerian law, and the continued detention, provided there exist further areas of investigation, is equally in line with the Nigerian law.
Is that also in line with the West African law?
We are turning the situation, taking advantage of the prevailing law and then exploiting the windows available within the context of the prevailing law that was applied in the conduct of the trial of the ECOWAS court as well.
The court says that the Nigerian government must pay 15 million naira to Dasuki as damages for the violation of his rights. Is this something you will do or you will challenge it?
That decision is open to further consideration, taking into consideration the prevailing law. So we look into it with a view to look at the available options open to us and then take a final decision thereon. It's not conclusive anyway against the background of the possibility or revisitation of the judgment if one is dissatisfied. But whatever it is, it's something we are studying and we take appropriate steps accordingly.
In the meantime, will you release Mr. Dasuki from further detention?
We are studying the ruling and then we'll take decision accordingly.
Mr. Attorney General, thank you. It's so nice to talk with you.
Thank you very much. I'm grateful.
Abubakar Malami is the Attorney General of Nigeria. He was speaking with me from Abuja. A new report says governance across Africa has improved a little in the past decade as poor security has held back progress in areas such as human rights and economic growth. As Henry Ridgewell reports, Libya is among the countries showing the steepest decline.
Almost 2 in 3 African citizens live in a country in which safety and the rule of law have deteriorated during the past decade, according to the annual Ibrahim Index on African Governance. The report rates 54 African countries on a range of criteria, including education, corruption and democracy. Presenting the findings Monday in London, the founder of the index, Sudanese-born billionaire and philanthropist Mo Ibrahim, said the statistics send a clear message.
This is a very strong mathematical correlation between safety and rule of law and development. And so we cannot say it more louder that we need peace in Africa.
Former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Jendayi E. Fraser, a member of the Mo Ibrahim Foundation, told VOA the decline in security is especially concerning.
Because it's dragging down governance as a whole, but also because it affects the lives of people. You know, when you're talking about personal safety and national security, you're talking about life and death.
Libya has shown one of the sharpest declines in national security and personal safety. Britain and France led the NATO airstrikes that helped to oust Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. Fraser says that intervention was a clear mistake.
We have lessons to learn, and one of the big lessons I would think is if the region is overwhelmingly against an intervention, you should hesitate. You should think twice. Another lesson should be if you're not prepared to fix it, don't break it.
Mauritius held on to the top spot, while Somalia remained at the bottom of the index. Rwanda was among the nations showing the fastest improvement, entering the top 10 for the first time. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The Liberian Supreme Court has again been asked to have a say in the ongoing dispute surrounding whether the Speaker of the House of Representatives should keep his job or be removed. Speaker Alex Tyler was removed on September 30th through a resolution signed by 49 members of the House. The Speaker had been asked to recuse himself from presiding over the House business until his criminal indictment for alleged bribery is resolved. But Speaker Tyler was not present when he was removed, apparently out of the country on a medical leave. A vote to elect a new Speaker was scheduled for yesterday, Tuesday, but the Speaker asked the Supreme Court to issue a writ of prohibition on the grounds he was not present when the vote to remove him was held. The court granted his wishes and issued a stay on the election. The Supreme Court has scheduled a conference today, Wednesday, between supporters of Speaker Tyler and those seeking to remove him. Edwin Snow is the past immediate former Speaker of the Liberian House of Representatives and a member of the group that has been pushing to remove the Speaker. He said the group believes it gave the Speaker due process, but will still accept whatever ruling the Supreme Court makes today, Wednesday.
We've made a determination that we will not meet on Wednesday till about 4:30, at which time we pray, and we only remain hopeful that by that time we would have heard from the High Court, because we have up to midnight Wednesday to make a determination. If we hear from the High Court by then based on the outcome, we will proceed based on the outcome. If the High Court upholds the prayer to place a prohibition, then we will formally close our session without having an election. Or if the High Court said the Speaker was removed illegally, then we will recognize the decision of the High Court, and then the Speaker will come back to be our Speaker. And then we will have to close until January will return, and then we can take further action. But whatever the decision of the High Court is what we will do.
Representative Snow, it seems to me you have a divided House of Representatives. I mean, no matter what happened, can you see this House of Representatives functioning in doing the people's business?
Definitely, James, definitely. In every democracy, you have a divided house. I mean, in the United States, you have the Republicans on one side, you have the Democrats on one side. They don't necessarily agree on all matters, but there are bipartisan approaches, and they work in the interest of the American people. In other democracies, you have the same thing. Unlike our democracy, where we have a multiplicity of representation of political parties in the legislature, sometimes it's difficult to trail party lines. So what people do normally, they form blocks based on their interests. And in this case, we form a block based on our interests, but not to the detriment of the Liberian people. So we continue to do the Liberian people's work. We continue to represent the people that have elected us. But notwithstanding, we will disagree from time to time. Our situation is not unique to the democratic tenets of any country. This is what happens in every democracy, and Liberia is no exception to disagreement in the legislature.
According to your bylaws, your legislative calendar should have ended now. Is that correct?
Accordingly, we should have ended. As a matter of fact, we should have ended on the 31st of August. Before the end of that legislature, we signed a resolution by 1/4 of the membership of the entire legislature, both the Liberian Senate and the House of Representatives, asking for a 1-month extension that will end on the 30th of September. And that end of September happens to be on last Friday. That was turning. Article 40 of the Liberian Constitution gives us the right to a call for another 5 days and not exceeding without the consent of the other house. So we're taking advantage of that constitutional provision. We believe that the speaker removal was legitimate. We believe that he was served due process. We believe that the order prayer asking for the stay order on the election, the administrative processes wasn't followed in the House of Representatives. So we believe that we do have a case. Notwithstanding, we cannot preempt the final decision from the court. So whatever the outcome is from the Supreme Court, you can take us on record for that. We'll respect the outcome of the Supreme Court. We'll respect the Supreme Court, and we'll proceed in accordance with the decision of the High Court.
Representative Edwin Snow is the past immediate former speaker of the Liberian House of Representatives. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. South Sudanese refugees who fled to neighboring Uganda from Ye River State's Morobo County last week during fighting between government forces and an armed group are calling on the government to restore peace in the area. Tito Justin has the story from Arua, Uganda.
The refugees say the main road linking Uganda and South Sudan has been rendered impassable by armed men who block the roads. Most people fleeing the area pass through the Democratic Republic of Congo before crossing into Uganda a distance of about 30 miles on foot. Morobo Moses fled with his two wives and two children from Morobo on foot last weekend following the renewed violence in the area. Moses says he is hopeful peace returns to South Sudan so that he can go back with his family.
We don't expect that incident to happen. Otherwise, we could be at our place called South Sudan. But due to this incident, then it has made everybody to get scared and even to fly out of South Sudan. We are just praying that everything at least has to be successful so that we can at least return.
On Monday evening, Moses and his family were relocated to Bidibidi camp. 2 days ago, Luisa Dawa fled Morobo County via the Democratic Republic of Congo to Uganda and says most of the roads are occupied by gunmen. She says the county has become too insecure for civilians.
The rebels really are around Morobo County. There are some people, few, who are left, but they are on the other side of Congo. What I have to say is really people have to leave that place because it's really so dangerous and many people are losing their life right now, as I'm saying.
Luca Remo fled Morobo County and is now in Uganda's Koboko district. Remo says once the two warring parties cease hostilities, he will return to South Sudan.
Then if people are going back, even I will go back even tomorrow. Let us struggle and then work for peace and then I want my people to come back. We settle together there, like before we stay there in Morobo.
Most of the South Sudanese fleeing Morobo are being taken to Bidibidi refugee camp of Yumbe district in northern Uganda. Last week, South Sudanese refugees said at least 6 children have died over the past month due to poor health services in the refugee camps in northern Uganda's Arua district. The refugees say the situation in the camps may worsen because of increased cases of acute diarrhea and malaria. Mawa George Lazarus is the executive director for Community Empowerment for Rehabilitation and Development, a local civil society organization in Yei. Lazarus says conflicts continue in South Sudan because of a lack of dialogue between the warring parties.
We tend to act when we are emotional, probably when we are angry, and we don't give chance for dialogue to prevail. And that is where we get ourselves into messes.
Lazarus believes the deployment of additional UN troops across the entire country will help data clashes between the parties. The government of South Sudan recently approved the UN's decision to send a 4,000-strong regional protection force to help protect the civilians and key government institutions. This is the sixth month since Ye River State, counties of Morobo, Lanya, and Kajokeji experienced the periodic insecurity. The UN earlier reported that about 100,000 Ye residents were stranded within the town with no means of escape. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin, in Arua District, Uganda.
And that's it for this Wednesday, October 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing every one of you in Africa a nice day.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight, comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.